Once again, we are back with Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That last track was All Ocean Views by the Brad Turner Trio Plus One. And coming up next, we have a very water-themed news piece for all of you coming out of Kingston, Ontario. This is about Watersheds Canada celebrating one of the biggest honors in its 23-year history. It is a national. After taking home the Small Project Conservation Award at the Water Canada Awards, the national charity was recognized for its winter walleye spawning bed restoration on Big Clear Lake in Central Frontenac Township. And this is a cool story because it's kind of a national acknowledgement of community-based conservation in a way that has proven to be really effective. So I thought I would play this for all of you. Once again, this is from CFRC in Kingston, Ontario.
A conservation project in eastern Ontario has earned major recognition. Watersheds Canada, a national nonprofit dedicated to protecting Canada's lakes and rivers, took home the Small Project Conservation Award at this year's Water Canada Awards for a winter restoration project on Big Clear Lake in central Frontenac Township. The community-driven project rebuilt a crucial walleye spawning bed, supporting an important native species and a cornerstone of the local fishery. This project is one of 68 completed across 44 bodies of water in central eastern Ontario since the Fish Habitat Program began 12 years ago. I spoke with Melissa Dakers, Habitat and Stewardship Program Manager with Watersheds Canada, about what this award has meant for her and her team and the work behind the project.
It celebrates not just our staff, but all the volunteers, the partners, and Indigenous leaders that we've worked with who make this work possible. It's a national acknowledgement that community-based conservation really works, and it gives everyone involved a lot of encouragement to keep going.
And the winning project was the Winter Walleye Spawning Bed Restoration Project on Big Clear Lake. I was wondering if you could give us a bit of an overview of what that was all about and why it needed to be done.
Yes. So Big Clear Lake, it has a historic walleye spawning bed that had become degraded over some time. We started this project actually in 2023 with our team and volunteers washing the spawning bed with high pressure water pumps and hoses. We scrubbed the rocks with brushes and removed all the algae and silt from the rock substrate. And then the second part of our project was actually supposed to take place the winter of 2024. But if you remember, last winter, it was extremely mild and the ice safety was actually a major concern for us. So we rescheduled it to 2025 to keep everyone safe. And so last winter in February, our team, along with our partners and local volunteers, we restored the site by laying down 17 tons of washed, clean river rock over the frozen lake, right above the spawning bed. And that rock actually creates the perfect spawning habitat for walleye, which are an important native species and a big part of the local ecosystem and fishery. It was cold, hard work, but the results will help keep this lake healthy for years to come. And this project was actually supported by Environment and Climate Change Canada's Environmental Damages Fund, with permits and approvals from the Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources and Fisheries and Oceans Canada. And it's one of 68 habitat projects that we've completed through our fish habitat program over the last 12 years.
Wow, 68. Geez. we've seen a decline in fish habitat across central and eastern Ontario. How does this project and all those other projects you guys are working on kind of help turn the tides?
Projects like this, they not only bring the community together, but what we're trying to do is make people aware of how helping to restore fish habitat can actually change a fishery on a lake. So by also planting your shorelines and reducing erosion so that there's not as much silt on the spawning beds, we can make a really big impact to our fisheries.
Mm-hmm. And you kind of got into this, but I was wondering if you could speak a bit more to how local volunteers and community partners were involved in this project.
Yeah, so honestly, this community was incredible, as are all the communities that we work with. But local volunteers, they brought their snow machines, their ATVs, and a ton of energy out onto a frozen lake to help move and spread the rock amidst a snowstorm. We were also closely working with the Big Clear Lake Association. GE Mattson and Sons Construction were there and donated time. And so were the Shabbat-Obadjuan First Nation. And Chief Doreen Davis even joined us that day. And she called it one of the building blocks of your life, which really captured how meaningful it actually was to have us all there. That shared spirit, people coming together to care for the land and the water, that's what makes these projects so powerful.
Mm-hmm. And moving forward, how can folks in the Kingston region get involved with projects like this and support your initiatives?
Yeah, there's lots of ways that people can get involved. People can visit watersheds.ca to learn about upcoming volunteer opportunities, shoreline restoration projects, or ways to donate to future fish habitat work. We are a nonprofit national charity located in Perth, Ontario, and we raise all our funds through donations, foundations, and grants. So personal donations are really greatly appreciated. And then even small actions at home, like keeping your shoreline natural or reducing runoff by planting native plants on a shoreline, can make a really big difference for water quality and for fish habitat. Every bit of local involvement helps protect the lakes and rivers that we all enjoy.
Once again, that was Melissa Dakers with Watersheds Canada. To learn more about their fish habitat programs, volunteer opportunities, and other ways to support future restoration work, you can visit watersheds.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Once again, thank you to Christina Laurie and CRFC for that piece on Watersheds Canada. And coming up next, we have a interview that I did about a month ago, but I thought I would play it again. This is on the Museum of Vancouver's exhibition documenting the lives of people living with long COVID. You know, right now in the thick of November, I think we are well into the cold and flu season and just the general ailment and sickness season. It feels pretty hard to escape for a lot of people, and I think in moments like this, it's good to put into perspective that there are a lot of people dealing with chronic illnesses that are acutely affected during this time of the year. And it's important to keep that in mind in instances of cold and flu and other things as well, such as COVID-19 and long COVID. So without further ado, here is that piece. Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Long COVID is a chronic medical condition that can consist of long-term and sometimes debilitating health issues as the result of a previous COVID-19 infection. The Museum of Vancouver's newest exhibit documents the everyday lives of people living with the condition, which, according to Statistics Canada, has now affected up to 1 in 9 Canadians. The exhibition is simply titled Living with Long COVID. For this exhibition, the Museum of Vancouver collaborated with researchers from Simon Fraser University's Faculty of Health Sciences and the Post-COVID-19 Interdisciplinary Clinical Care Network. The exhibition is primarily photography-based, with clusters of pictures and text provided by individuals living with long COVID who agreed to participate in the exhibition. To find out more about what the exhibition entailed, CJSF visited the Museum of Vancouver, where we were able to speak with Viviane Gosselin, the museum's curatorial lead. The first question we asked was, how did this exhibition and collaboration with SFU and the Clinical Care Network come to be?
Yeah, so excellent question. I will say that about half our exhibitions are proposed by people, partners, organizations outside the Museum of Vancouver. So so we remember receiving a call from the Faculty of Health Sciences. So Rakib Tesfaye, who's a researcher there, approached us and just called me by saying, we work with long haulers, like so people living with long COVID, and doing research on the subject, and yet working with long haulers, they have told us that they feel invisible and would like to work on something public where they can express themselves and talk about this issue.
Next, we asked what the community response has been like so far for this exhibition on living with long COVID.
I will say for the long haulers, when they come here, and we met quite a few actually on opening day, and the general sense was they were pleased and happy to see themselves, even though they had not necessarily participated in and submitted photos for the project. They saw themselves, they felt heard, felt seen. So that was, that was very positive because that was like one of the goals. The other goal was public awareness, right? Like destigmatize also the topic of long COVID because it is misunderstood. People don't want to talk about it, or people feel judged because people are if they're talking about their symptoms, because there's not a lot of public education on the topic, these individuals feel that like the message they get is it's all in your head. You should try to do some yoga and a bit of exercise and you'll feel better.
We then asked what reactions they received from individuals attending this exhibition that may not have been informed about long COVID beforehand.
There's, members of the public who, really hadn't planned to see an exhibition on long COVID, but just stumbled upon it. And we hear their comments, we do some tracking, and we can see people are surprised. Again, they're surprised by how little they knew about the condition. And also about the severity of the condition. Like the people who submitted, the vast majority are homebound, and their daily life has changed radically since getting COVID and living with the aftermath. And for people in the public health sector, I hope it's going to be a bit of a shakeup, right? Like when museums are partnering with research centers in making this more public, it means that it has to be felt in like daily practitioners, like physicians should know more about it. And also it is underdiagnosed, right? So if practitioners, health practitioners are more attuned, they may be able to refer their patients to specialists and support them in their healing or just kind of stabilizing their condition.
Afterwards, we asked Ghislain if she could go over some of the experiences depicted by those living with long COVID who submitted photos and text for this exhibition.
Part of this project, it's a photo-based project, it's about self-documentation and representation, and we said that part of the constraint, if you want, is document your day, and you can submit one and up to 6 images for that day, right? And so what strikes me is when people are making reference to their life before, like everything that they were doing, and how, for example, now just going and walking a short walk around the corner or just walking your dog for 15 minutes will completely like drain them. They have to go back to bed, right? So that's struck me, is how their life has been, like kind of their day-to-day life has been, their universe has shrunk, if I can say it that way. But at the same time, we see great efforts to, figure out how to feel better, document their conditions, like a lot of kind of resourcefulness, and they know that they have this one appointment, and like prepping and researching and trying to understand best they can, like, so a lot of agency in that, like kind of trying to take some control over their condition. And yeah, looking at when I keep seeing like pets, like dogs and cats, I think provides great comfort to people who have them. Like they, it's something that they mention. It's like, I don't know what I would do if I didn't have, you know, so and so. And so I think that presence is, you know, alleviates, if you want, some of the symptoms at times. But we also see these photos where someone made little stars out of like the many pills and supplements they have to take. So a lot of people are showing their bottles of you know, medication and you know, prescribed and not prescribed, and creating their own, you know, cocktail. And again, this is not filtered by a medicalized eye. This is very much the lived experience of long haulers. So we're not saying, hey, this is your treatment. Like for those who, it's this is them sharing what they're living. And I think whether you're from, you know, like you're a researcher or a scientist or just a member of the public, I think essentially we're asked to bear witness. And you know, if people had not given any thoughts about this issue, this is the time to think about what that means. And given the high number of Canadians, so 1 out of 9 has experienced long COVID, thinking about our, you know, our friends and neighbors, and like, guaranteed, Danny, that you know people who are living with long COVID. And so how can we help? Is there, you know, how can we support these people?
Lastly, Viviane Gosling left us with what she hopes people are able to take away from the Living with Long COVID exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver.
I'd say come, and I'm in awe with the courage and honesty of long haulers. I, you know, have deep admiration, and yeah, I'm humble, and I hope that people will come, because the more we get to understand the experience of these people, but also the context and the condition, because there's our partners at SFU had, you know, had produced short texts about what is long COVID and what are the symptoms and the kind of impact it has. I think we have a responsibility to educate ourselves.
Once again, that was our conversation with Viviane Gosling, the curatorial lead for the Museum of Vancouver, on the Living with Long COVID exhibition, which is up until March 22nd, 2026. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Bird Note. Stand on a rocky headland above the turbulence of the tidal surge flowing like a river. Loose groups of red-throated loons in flight, perhaps 1,000 altogether, stream past. The tide has turned at Deception Pass at the north end of Whidbey Island in Washington State. The loons gather here in winter. The once great salmon and steelhead rivers still carry nutrients from the Cascade Mountains to feed the marine life of northern Puget Sound. In some years, forage fish such as surf smelt abound. They're caught in the irresistible tug of the tide, pulled out to sea through the granite defile of the pass. The loons fly to the throat of the pass and feast as the current carries them down. The loon's name derives from the Old Norse word for lame. Because their feet are so far back on their bodies, the birds cannot walk on land. But in flight, they're graceful, and underwater, swift in pursuit. Some creatures with which we share the world have been diminished almost to disappearance. But if we look, we can still find great natural abundance, as we have today. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein.
The Bulkley Valley Museum in Smithers is inviting the community to help build its next exhibit, and it's all about celebration. The exhibit, called Smithers Celebrates, is a community-curated display that highlights the many ways people in the valley mark the season, from Christmas tree ornaments and family recipes to Diwali lamps and cultural traditions from around the world. I sat down with Kira Wespe, curator of the Bulkley Valley Museum, to talk about how the idea came together, what kinds of submissions they're hoping to receive, and how this exhibit reflects Smithers' growing diversity and shared love of celebration.
My name is Kira Wespe, and I'm the curator of the Bulkley Valley Museum.
We're talking today about Smithers Celebrates. Can you tell me and our listeners what that is?
So Smithers Celebrates is what we're hoping is going to be a community curated or contributed exhibit. We essentially have a weird 4-week gap in our exhibit schedule between two traveling shows, and that's not a lot of time to try and put together a whole exhibition of historical material because there's usually quite a lot of research involved. And I started to think about how much Smithers loves Christmas. Smithers is super Christmassy, as we all know, and it was like, oh, we need to have people bring in their favorite Christmas tree ornament or recipe, and it could be on display, and maybe we could be open during Christmas in the Valley and have people come in to see what they submitted or what their friends submitted. And then I started to think we should really go beyond that, because there's a whole lot of other things that are celebrated in this community now, or has been for a while. But I think Smithers has definitely become more diverse in the 10 years that I've been living here. And it was like, this is a great way to share that growing diversity and all of the different types of celebrations that are happening in the community, some that we may be really aware of, like Christmas, and some we might be less aware of, and to help newcomers to the community share their culture as well. So I said, let's open it up to any festival, any celebration, any tradition that you have in your family. Bring us an item, whether it's something like a Christmas tree ornament, or my coworker is going to be submitting really related to a dish that her family, they're French Canadian, a dish they always make at Christmas, so a recipe. We've had a submission that's going to be a lamp from Diwali and some photos of holly being celebrated locally. We've had a couple submissions so far, and they're right in the spirit of what I was hoping to see, which is really great.
Yeah, nice. So you're looking for people to make submissions. How and when's the deadline?
So on our website, bvmuseum.org, under news or under exhibits, you can find it in two places. There's links for the Smithers Celebrates page of information. And we have an online Google submission forms, or people can come in with their idea and we can take down the information in the museum as well. We're here all day during the week. We're hoping to have all the submissions come in by November 7th, but we understand that people might be hearing about it a little bit after the deadline. So even into next week, past Remembrance Day, if you have something and you think, oh no, I missed the deadline, don't worry about that. We're happy to keep adding things. The deadline was more so we had a sense of how much do we have to chase people down, and also so we know for generating the information that goes with the stuff and printing it, just to give ourselves time for that. We're hoping to have everything up and put together by November 24th, and it'll be on display till December 20th, so it ends up being about 4 weeks for the display.
Yeah, that's really nice. We're sitting in front of something that someone submitted. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure, yeah. So actually, this is an item from the museum's collection that we're going to be putting in, because we have a couple items to show. And it's a rolling pin for making, and all the Germans in the crowd, please forgive me, Springele, which is a type of biscuit that is associated with Advent and with Christmas in German tradition. So the rolling pin has all these cutouts in it for making cookies that when you roll it, they come out with these little patterns on them. And this is traditional in Germany at the Christmas time of year. They're anise flavored. The Dutch do a similar one called, again, forgive me, speculoos, similar kind of thing. And they're sometimes the German ones are actually hung on the Christmas tree when they dried out, or they may be eaten or given as gifts. So this is an example of a tradition that's come to Canada and come to Smithers with somebody. And that's exactly what we're looking for. Is Canada is a multicultural place, so is Smithers. Mm-hmm. So what are all these different pieces that are part of celebrations? And it is incredible when you start to look into it a little bit. It's like almost pretty much every religion has some sort of festival of light, festival of spring. We like to celebrate the same sorts of things. And so you see these commonalities in these threads, things like special biscuits, special breads, special recipes. These are all across different traditions. We're excited to see those. If you're not sure if what you're thinking of is what we want, get in touch with us. It probably is. And for those of you who are thinking of loaning something that is Christmas related, the last date of the show is the 20th. So we're going to get it back to you in time for Christmas. You can still hang it on your tree or use it to make your Christmas Day fruitcake or whatever you're doing. So yeah.
Thank you.
Of course. Thanks very much.
CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.
Once again, thank you to CICK News in Smithers and Pam Hassan for that piece. We've reached the very end of the hour, but make sure you stay tuned for the rest of the day. Got a lot of amazing programming coming your way, including Democracy Now! At the top of the hour at 11 a.m. Before we get into that, I'm going to close off today's episode of Speak Up with Sour Dope with Water Temple. Once again, thank you all so much for tuning in. And you'll see me, or you'll hear from me, next week, Tuesday, 10 a.m. Stay tuned.